This weekend, around the country and around the world, emotions are running high with the inauguration of Donald Trump. So we thought for this week's bonus weekend podcast, we could take a break from all the serious presidential coverage and revisit some of our favorite interviews with comedians. In 1999, I spoke with the late Joan Rivers about her book, Don't Count the Candles. In 2001, George Carlin joined me in studio to discuss his book, Napalm and Silly Putty. And in 2012, Judd Apatow talked about finding humor in daily life and his creative process for his uniquely comedic movies. Enjoy. Although he first made his name for irreverent counterculture humor in the 60s, George Carlin has established himself as one of our most popular and enduring comedy stars. Many anti-establishment comics use their humor for social protest, but Mr. Carlin has said that the difference with him is that there's no underlying wish that things will get better. His next HBO comedy special is called I Kinda Like It When a Lot of People Die. He has won 3 Grammy Awards for his albums and received 5 Emmy nominations. His 1997 book, Brain Dropping, spent 40 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and now there's a new book of his wit and wisdom. I assume it's going to be on the New York Times bestseller list soon. It's called Napalm and Silly Putty. It's published by Hyperion. I'm very pleased to welcome George Carlin back to New York and Company. Hi.
Thank you, Leonard. Thank you.
You were just given a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Comedy Awards. Do you feel like the elder statesman of comedy?
No, just enduring was a good word. But I think they like to give that award to you while you're still young enough to lift it. So I told them I'd be back for a part two. It was just a down payment.
Well, you've said that you admired Bob Hope when you were a kid.
Yeah, but in the movies, it was how I knew him.
And that's the way a lot of us knew him, yes. As a comic actor.
Yes, yes.
But he was doing stand-up all along.
Right.
You said recently that he was in a walking form of death. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I must have been talking about a recent picture of him or something.
I guess he does look pretty terrible. You don't want to go on that long.
I wouldn't mind it, but I don't think I'd be going to events. I don't think I'd be singing, help me out with my tie. I'd rather just be at home and play some music.
Well, we can't predict whether we're going to when we're going to die, and some people live to 100.
Right, and I expect to be fully active with my own creative mind as long as that lasts. You know, you can be alive and not so creative, I guess. But I do expect that to go right through my 90s. I know Linus Pauling was in his early 90s and had published 3 papers that year, I think. Mm-hmm. So
I was taking a lot of vitamin C. Are you eating a lot of vitamin C?
I do indeed. But there are a lot of examples of that. And if you're lucky that the genetic thing is just right and the bus just misses you, you're okay.
When your wife passed away in 1997, you said that you were thinking of moving back to New York. Have you come back home?
No, I didn't quite do that. About a little more than a year after Brenda died, I met a woman who's in my life now, and we're very, very, very much in love. And she has a place on the canals in Venice, California, which is the nicest place to live in L.A. because it has a little of the feeling of France and Greenwich Village thrown together. So I'm quite content, and I have my New York quite often throughout the year, so it might be nicer this way.
Well, you grew up in Harlem.
Yeah, Upper West Side, yeah.
Have you gone back to your old neighborhood?
Oh, I've been there a lot over the years, sure. My street is nicer now than it was. Most people say, how could you, boys, and probably all deteriorated? I say, no, it's actually a little nicer. Columbia bought everything and fixed it up. It wasn't so bad then. I was on the actual street of where Teachers College was, and my own church and school were there, Corpus Christi. But the whole neighborhood is still nice, and I still love it, and I still see a few guys who haven't left.
And do you follow things? When President Clinton said that he was going to open up offices there, did you feel, he's going to my old neighborhood?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the nice thing about having a thorough grounding of Manhattan Island, which I do from running around like as a kid on unsupervised, all over the island, is that you can picture most of the places that you read about or hear about when they say he's doing this, or they say, oh, I know where that is. I see my house.
Well, so many Americans know it simply from watching the movies.
Right, of course. But, and I love seeing, if there's anything I love, it's a movie with some New York exteriors, especially from the 50s and the 40s when I was, because it's just those visual things just hit you like a thunderbolt.
A few years ago, you said that you were inspired by Sam Kinison. Had you become too nice as a comic in your own eyes?
No, it wasn't that. There were a number of things that converged, actually, and that was one of them. And I was referring there to raising your voice on stage, literally, and then in a figurative sense as well.
Because you have a deep voice. You don't want to raise it too much.
No. I had, though, collected for a long time files, and still do, and many of them had what you might call social or political overtones to them, and they were about issues, and they hadn't fully matured over those earlier years, and so I didn't use them very much. I didn't go into them and mine any of that stuff. And it was when Sam Kinison raised his voice literally that I thought, it wasn't an immediate association, but it was a beginning of a transitional period when I began to be a little more strident on stage and include some of these things where I have attitudes that are a little offbeat. So it was a kind of a catalyst.
Well, hadn't you started that way? You were originally inspired by Lenny Bruce, who was probably the most un-PC comic of any time.
Yeah,
and then because you had become such a success, advisors telling you tone it down?
No, I never had advisors, and I never would listen to anyone in that role. What happened was I was a young boy and a young man, adolescent, very much out of step and very much swimming against the tide. Kicked out of or quit most things that were organized and that had rules and regulations to them, and did not fit, did not get along, didn't like authority. However, I had my Danny Kaye dream, which was to be some sort of a comic actor in the movies like Danny Kaye.
Did you want to sing and dance too?
Not quite that, but I knew I was physical and I could do some of the things he did with his face and his torso and his arms, and he was very physical, and voice especially. So without consciously knowing it, I had these two levels, this A and this B side. And the B side I'm thinking of is this Danny Kaye mainstream dream. And I pursued that without realizing it was inconsistent with my real behaviors and how I felt about the society and so forth. So when the counterculture began to take shape in the late 60s, mid to late 60s, I began to notice that, and my own sense of being in the wrong place, entertaining the wrong people, was more apparent to me. And that is when I began to let myself evolve and change a little into a person I had felt like all along, that is the out-of-step, discontented person, the malcontent.
So you gave up wanting to say the chalice with the palace,
the vessel with the pestle. Absolutely.
And now what we have is an HBO special, your 12th, which is going to be airing in
November.
The fall.
Yeah.
It's called I Kinda Like It When a Lot of People Die. I can't imagine Danny Kaye ever saying that.
No. And it's about the fact that I enjoy watching the disintegration of the culture and the human species on which I have officially given up. I'm sure when you scratch a cynic, you find a disappointed idealist, and I'm sure the flame still burns low. But as a position that I formally have adopted, at least, and internally as well, it's just that I guess push came to shove. Perhaps I might not act on it at the last moment. But it's how I feel that I don't think there's much can be done about the way things are, except little Band-Aids here and there. And so I just as soon see the whole thing hasten down the drain.
So you want him to drop the big one?
I don't. I'd rather have it be a comet or an asteroid. I'd like it coming from nature itself. I'd like for it to be similar to what happened to the reptiles, what happened to these primates, and let the insects have a chance.
Well, it's probably more likely because the president is going to put up SDI and we're going to be saved from any possible attack by the Soviet Union if it ever comes back. We'll be thoroughly safe. My guest is George Carlin, and he has a new book out called Napalm and Silly Putty. It is published by Hyperion. Why this title?
Well, I've always drawn from my material I think of it as three sources. The more obvious one of the obvious ones is the English language and speech, how we speak and how we communicate verbally. And then the other two areas were what I think of as the little world and the big world. The little world being those universal things we all, they call it observational humor sometimes. What's in the refrigerator, your pet's behavior and how you drive.
Those the mundane that, details of
yes,
everyday life.
Right, things that everyone experiences. And then there are what I think of as the larger world, which is the issues, the things that that will probably never go away. I don't like topical humor, but I do like what I think of as somewhat timely humor, issues that are in the news but that are not resolvable.
Now, that love of language that you were talking about, that's something
So the Napalm and Silly Putty, by the way, I didn't answer the question fully. The Napalm and Silly Putty are supposed to identify those two parts of my nature. There is an innocence and a childlike wonder in some of the things I write, and then there is this other strident self. So the Napalm is obviously the strident self.
And it's kind of, well, it's soft and softer.
Yes. Good.
You talked about the focus on language. That's something that's self-taught. You're an autodidact, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I left school in ninth grade and always did well in school in terms of academics, but I was not interested so much in behaving the way it was expected.
So they asked you to leave?
No. I quit school at the end of ninth grade.
And what did you do?
I wanted to go to the High School of Music and Art. I was still too young to quit school. I went to the High School of Music and Art and or the School of Performing Arts. And I was young, 15, obviously. I quit Cardinal Hayes. I quit the school I was in without having a transfer to another school. And I went out to apply, as it were, and I went to music and art. And here I was. I didn't get credit for the semester of 10th grade that I was in, so I had a year and a half, basically, of time under my belt. And at music and art, they said, well, you know, you'd have to audition. First of all, I did play trumpet, not very well, by the way, but I did play. That was going to be my pass to get in there. And they said, well, you'd have to audition. And I said, oh, yeah. And then they said, you'd have to start high school again so that you could have theory, harmony, conducting, composing, and arranging. And, well, at 15, you don't want to lose a year and a half. So it was the same thing with performing arts. They wanted fencing and speech and movement and things. And so there I was without a school. So I went to George Washington, to a public school, to fill out the 6 months before I could legally quit, which is what I did at 16.
Mm. And then you quit and went to do what?
I quit, and I had a year to kill before I could join the Air Force, because my plan was join the Air Force, get out of it as quickly as possible, and get the GI Bill and learn to be a disc jockey. That was going to be step one. So the Air Force, you couldn't join until you were 17, so I worked at Western Union in the plant department as a junior clerk for a year.
And if it all had worked out, you would have been Howard Stern instead of what you are.
That's right.
George Carlin has been writing and performing comedy since 1960. He's released 18 albums. Four of them have been gold, won 2 Grammy Awards. He's done 12 HBO stand-up comedy specials with 2 Emmy nominations, 2 Cable Ace Awards, and he performs over 100 concerts a year. We are not mentioning the movies and the cable TV shows and all
that
other stuff. And another thing that he does is write books. The latest is called Napalm and Silly Putty. It is published by Hyperion. We will continue our conversation right after this. George Carlin is with us. His latest book is called Napalm and Silly Putty. It's published by Hyperion. And there is an HBO special that we can expect next fall. Something you're working on now?
Well, I work all year round on the next HBO show. It's just the way I work. The HBO show is always a result of about 2 years' work of breaking down the past show. They're always an hour. And building up the new one. So the timing has been roughly 2 years, and that's what the show now largely represents that.
So if I see you perform live, I will see part of what we talked about the last time you were here and part of what you'll be doing in the new show.
Yeah, if you were to be at Westbury, for instance, at the Music Fair on the 10th, 11th, or 12th, which is my birthday, the third day, you would see pretty much the whole hour. I'm way ahead of schedule this time. And I'm gonna do some more pieces so I can just further take out the softer spots.
Now, going back, you said that your plan was to go into the Army.
Yes.
Was it the Army?
The Air Force,
and then later become a DJ.
Right.
You did become a DJ.
What happened was in the Air Force, my timetable was advanced dramatically. I was a DJ by the time I was 19. I had expected to get out of the Air Force at 21 and go to school for being a DJ, such as school is for that. And what happened was I met the owner of the local radio station, the big station. I was in Shreveport, Louisiana. They had, but it was a great radio market. They had 9 stations. It was a very active market. They had 250,000 watters there, and they had this little day timer, 1,000 watts, and it was number one. We had a 52 share. Average 52 wow. share in a 9 station market because we were the first ones to play top 40. There were only about 5 stations in the whole country who played it. Rock and roll was just a year old. It was 1956 when I got there. And I had my own show when I was 19. So by the time I did get out of the Air Force, I had advanced my timetable very much and was able to spend a couple more years in radio and then go on to stand-up. My plan as a child was to be a disc jockey first. That would be easy because the audience isn't present. And then secondly, some sort of a stand-up nightclub comedian, and then to try to get into the movies, and that was the plan.
The audience isn't present, in other words. You were afraid that you'd have to stand up in front of people, but well, was that a problem overcoming that?
No, I just thought it was the easy way in. I just thought it sounded like a shoehorn into it.
It's been my experience that even when I interview somebody who's a serious novelist, I once interviewed Nadine Gordimer, and the next thing I knew she was making jokes because there was an audience there. People do tend, some people anyway, do tend to really eat it up when they get laughter.
Yeah, and they're probably that way in large parties and large gatherings. So they're probably just very outgoing, I think, and gregarious and able to do that.
Well, you've done everything and you're still working in films, but you always come back to the stand-up. That was your first love and it remains your first love, like a theater actor?
Actually, the description is a little different. What I have become more so now than ever is a writer. I always wrote my own material and I always wrote for myself. And the stand-up is the central part of this whole thing. Writing for the stand-up. The stand-up becomes the HBO, it becomes the CD. So they're just manifestations of the writing. The movies were always a sideline, always a separate, like a spur.
But you're reading somebody else's lines.
Yes, and portraying a character, and it's just a totally different thing, obviously. I mean, it goes without saying. But what I've found is that I can also write for the page, that I can adapt things that were intended for the ear, for the eye, and that I can start from scratch and write for the eye. And that has opened my world up quite a bit.
You have to write differently. You go back to an old routine and adapt it to a book, since you rely so much on intonation, on pauses, how do you make that adjustment?
Well, I write it as a reader. I mean, I read it with my eyes instead of the way when I'm doing stand-up writing, periodically I do the thing out loud and I say, that's all wrong. Hold on, that's all wrong. That's not the way I would say that. So that helps. In this case, I read it knowing that anyone can go back over it, that they can just read the paragraph again or they can read it the next day, and I make sure that it's the way it ought to be.
And do you find that a punchline has to be rewritten because it works so well when you give it a certain inflection?
Sometimes it's just a few things like prepositions and words that seem unimportant in the sentence that make it work for the brain as opposed to coming into the ear.
And you told me last time you were here that once you have written it for performance, it's always the same.
Well,
even if there's a pause, even if you cough in the middle of a sentence, that's the way it's written.
Well, if I like polishing something like a sculptor and handing it to you and saying this is the finished product. I don't like this idea of I do that a little differently every night because I find in the kind of comedy I like to do, kind of ideas I like to use, economy of language and precision is what makes the thing work, and cutting out the unnecessary parts is what makes a lot of things work.
But you're such a witty guy, and I'm sure in the middle of doing the act, something suddenly occurs to you. You just squelch it?
No. There are times like that, but it's early in the development of the piece. It's in the first few months, not so much once. What I do is I revise maybe 15 or 20 times before I start to memorize. Then once it's memorized, I put it on stage, and it can change some more in the first few months because actually I do a thing now where I read things to them. I'll read one piece in each show and explain to them. It's like workshop, and it allows me to hear the piece and hear myself do it before. It's not so much to gauge their appreciation of it as it is to hear where the soft spots are. I said, I don't want to say that. That's, you know, I'm getting away from it. So then I go back and I'll do a few more revisions. But after 2 months on stage with something, it's pretty well set.
And you've been doing it for so long, 40 years or so.
Yeah.
By now, do you pretty much know when you're writing something,
yes,
this is really going to do well?
Yeah, I can trust it. That's the feeling I get at the when I'm writing at the keyboard. There's just this wonderful moment that happens, and what it amounts to is, oh, wait till I hear this. I can't wait to tell him this.
Do you laugh?
I laugh at some things, sure, and especially when I go back to them a week later, fresh thoughts that I haven't seen in a week.
Well, we were talking earlier about how you've changed. Sam mm-hmm. Kinison freed you up, I assume.
That was in the late 80s.
But I assume a lot of other things that have happened since have freed you up. There's a whole new group of comedians who are doing things that are different, and then there's a whole atmosphere. Howard Stern, mm-hmm. for example, can even say a few of the words that you included in mm-hmm. the 7 words you couldn't say.
I might take issue with that. There's one word on there that you can say for anger. You can say pissed off, but you can't use it for urination. You mm-hmm. can't say pissed on. If you change the preposition,
we just said it.
I know it. If we change the preposition, we change the not just the meaning, but the inherent morality, perhaps, is what we're being led to believe by some. So the rest of that list is still pretty much intact. It's those words that have more than one meaning that now get through. Mm-hmm. The words that have a dirty meaning and a clean meaning that now get through, and I won't bother giving you a list of those.
But are you surprised when you see something like NYPD Blue and they say things that you know 15 years ago you could not have said, probably in some theaters in the United States.
Well, no, I'm not surprised at all. The culture has obviously shifted and changed and relaxed some of these standards. It has become degraded. But the word that was used on NYPD that they made such an issue, I thought that was the whole point. The fact that they had to make an issue of it sort of proves the point. It's not used casually on television. It was used as an event. Mm-hmm. And I think
self-consciously.
I think that points out the very thing I'm saying, is that these words seem to be a big problem for us when they shouldn't be.
Well, when you do these HBO specials, you don't have to worry about that at all.
No commercial considerations.
Because people are paying to see that, and that changes everything.
Yeah. Television and radio are, to a great degree, advertising media. They really have very little to do with entertainment or art. In the way we know them in their most familiar form, commercial radio and television. So when businessmen don't want to offend a potential customer, they make sure it doesn't happen, and that's the reason that works. And then there's this argument that, well, these things come into the home unbidden, but that's not true, because there are dials and switches and knobs on these implements, and you can change them.
Well, you've been in all the different media. You've been on PBS doing a kids show.
Yes.
You've had your own sitcoms.
Uh-huh.
You've been in a wide range of movies, including not just Dogma, which seemed to be very consciously attempting to offend everybody, but now I gather you're in the sequel. I guess you didn't have enough, so now you're in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Well, I like Kevin, and
Kevin Smith.
Kevin Smith, and he wrote the Dogma Cardinal part for the, by the way, Catholic cardinal with a Jewish name. I thought Cardinal Glick was nice. But I like Kevin, and he asked me to do a small thing, and it was really literally a page. So it's brief. But I am in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, and it's like a bit of a repertory family now.
And religion has been a major source of material for you.
Yeah, I have another nice piece. I have this new HBO show has a deconstruction of the Ten Commandments and why you only really need two. And it's very logical. The thing I love about it is it's built on beautiful logic.
What are the two? You mind telling
the two,
us?
Well, it leaves out all the fun of arriving at them. But I reduce the two honesty commandments and the two fidelity commandments to one big honesty fidelity commandment. Lying and stealing are both dishonest acts, so they belong under one commandment, thou shalt not be dishonest. Adultery and coveting someone's wife are both about marital fidelity. And fidelity and honesty are basically the same overall value, so we reduce them all, those four, to one. We eliminate the three at the beginning that are all about spooky language designed to scare primitive people, and we wind up with and we eliminate the one on coveting thy neighbor's goods, because that's what keeps the economy going. So we wind up with just the two, thou shalt always be honest and faithful, and thou shalt not kill. But religion does not always have a problem with murder. You know, it's a negotiable deal to a religious person. Depends on who's doing the killing. So I wind up with just two commandments.
You have an interview with Jesus in the book,
yeah,
Napalm and Silly.
I'm very proud of that. I had done that once on a studio album that I made, and I revised it. I looked at it. I fixed it. I worked on it, and I made it, I think, twice as good. And it's nice. He's a very folksy kind of a guy who probably would talk like this. You know, they ask him, are there really angels? And he says, yeah, well, you don't have as many. You can't get the young people to join, what with the heat-seeking missiles in the radar. But he's that kind of a guy, kind of a neighborhood guy.
We've come a long way from the time when Lenny Bruce was arrested for making fun of the
sure
Catholic
have.
Church.
Yeah, and I was, I did a recent interview for a documentary concerning Lenny, and so I'm re-familiar. I mean, I'm recently familiar again with some of those feelings.
My guest is George Carlin. His latest book is Napalm and Silly Putty from Hyperion. And if the past is any indication of the future, this book will also be, excuse me, a monster bestseller. The last one was on the New York Times bestseller list for how long?
42 weeks and sold so far 750,000, which they tell me is really good for a comedian.
Well, it's really good for anybody.
For a lot of folks, yeah.
That means that may be the bestseller. I don't know. Can you just write books and live on the royalties of the books, or would you have to perform even if you weren't making as much money?
There's a part of me that would want – I intend to make a transition to Broadway style one-person performances, which are always what I've done anyway, but more with something more thematic, with a tiny bit of staging, tiny bit of production to it, not a lot, but largely themed, and that would be the thing I would use my voice for, and then I will try to find more reasons to write books. I have a few ideas.
Like more like a stand-up act or more like what Lily Tomlin
well,
does?
Well, that's just
different
it.
Characters.
It's much closer to Eric Bogosian or Lily Tomlin. But I probably will have trouble altering my voice from the pure stand-up style to the middle distance of Broadway. But I can feel it already that it's doable for me. And I think the subject matter I've chosen for the two shows I have in mind at this time both lend themselves to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've now had all this experience as an actor. Do you think that being a comic and delivering lines in a funny way is all that different? Many people have pointed out that it's a lot harder to do comedy than to do drama.
And those are people who are generally trained for drama and approach comedy as an acting task. What I do is an extension of my personality. It's a way of formalizing a person I would want to be at the party.
So you're typecast in a way.
I am indeed, and I'm. It's all self-generated, so there's no acting involved.
Now, in recent things, you've made jokes about murder, rape, even child abuse. You say things like you're glad Monica Seles got stabbed.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Is there anything that's off limits? Anything that you can't joke about?
No, of course not. It's all in the context. If you raise it in a context where you create a frame for some humor, even if it's macabre or somewhat distasteful to some, I think it works. Creating the context for the audience is what makes the things work. I try to sense where the line is when I'm devising these ideas, sense where people's lines are drawn, and then deliberately cross them. And
so you get the
well. Sometimes it's never audible, but you can sense sphincters tightening in the audience, and you can hear a bit of a hush. And I like that moment because then what I'm hoping for is to describe this line to myself, cross it deliberately, and take them across it with me, and have them glad for the experience.
That Monica Seles was stabbed?
Glad that I had opened the thing up for examination in a funny way. Mm-hmm. Not glad for the fact of what I'm saying, so much as glad that, that's not as forbidden as I thought. That's not as scary territory as I expected. He made it safe for me.
Mm-hmm. Because you're really opening it up for an examination of all the things that surround it. You're not...
I say, for instance, in this new book, I talk about rappers killing each other. I said, I like this sort of thing. First of all, I'm entertained by this entire freak show we're in. When you become an American citizen, you buy a ticket to a freak show, and you better enjoy it. If you're going to stand around and go, oh, isn't this awful, you're not in the spirit of it. So I enjoy it for what it is, and I said, I'd like to see more entertainers and celebrities killing each other. Wouldn't it be fun, for instance, to see Dan Rather sneak up and stab Tom Brokaw in the head during the news. I think it would be very amusing.
So, we could have a reality TV show like that.
That's right. And so the idea is to take it to the absurd level so that it does become a parody of itself.
You have a website. You like it because you can get topical material up the same day that it becomes relevant. That's something you can't do in your act.
I can't. I don't like to do it in my act because of the perishability factor. But as I get more involved with my not just my own website, but laugh.com, by the way, is a comedian's website that I have an interest in. I must confess to that. But I'm one of the founding members. And the nice thing is I will have a little TV camera set up at home so that I can produce a minute or two or 5 minutes in a day, hand it to the fellow who codes it, and put it on the air.
Now, you may have done this thing with other comics, but you say that you don't hang out with other show
business
people.
No, that was...
Do you hang out with comics?
No, I don't hang out with anybody. I'm very solo.
I was going to ask you out for drinks afterward. You're not going to hang out, George?
I'd probably be you know, sitting there squirming. I'm not good at that. I really love my solitude, and I love being in love with Sally, and the two of us are of the same type. We both enjoy not mixing, not going to people's places and feeling obligated to have them over. So it's kind of fun. I grew up that way, and I think that's where I got that from.
Because most comics hang out with each other, and they challenge each other. That's the way they hone
their
skills.
They're compulsive performers. I think they're not quite satisfied with their stage experience.
Well, you're performing for people you call stupid white people, and yet they keep on coming back for more.
Well, I try to improve their lot.
And you've been doing a pretty good job. George Carlin's latest book is called Napalm and Silly Putty. It's published by Hyperion. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard, for your interest, too.
If you're at the point in your life where they need a blowtorch to light your birthday candles and Hurricane Andrew to snuff them out, well, don't despair, because Joan Rivers has the book for you. From the entertainer whose favorite initials are QVC and not AARP, comes a new book devoted to helping you feel young at any age. It's called Don't Count the Candles, Just Keep the Fires Lit. And it's just out from HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it brings the Emmy Award-winning talk show host, actress, comedian, best-selling author, and accessories activist, Joan Rivers, back to New York and Company. Hello.
Could you just add Tony nominee? Because that was the most important thing in my life.
But you could have won, Joan. You should have won.
I should have won that year, but they gave it to Dame somebody. Dame Stupid.
Well.
The English come over and everyone goes.
I've heard you called a dame. I don't know. I don't know why, but whenever I see you, I feel a sudden urge to either buy jewelry or tell you about what I'm wearing.
Great. I wonder why. Isn't that nice? Isn't that funny how things occur in your life? We did this little tiny show, the pre-Oscar show, the pre-Emmy show, because we're doing them all, my daughter and I, thinking nobody would watch, and we just dished, and now it's become this big institution.
Did you really think Helen Hunt had the best dress?
In person, she looked divine.
Because it looked really weird on
You know
television.
What's funny? Helen Hunt and Celine Dion, and then we'll get into the book, I promise you, don't count the candles.
That's okay, you know.
But they both came to the
Oscars. A lot of
older
people are going to be very upset by this book.
Good, we'll talk about that. But they both came to the Oscars wearing right off the runways in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And the press had just raved about these outfits. Now, the two of them walk in right off the runways, bought them off the runways, and the press says they look like stupid idiots. Well, you can't say one is great and one is terrible.
Well, you have, you know, the woman on the runway who wore it looked perfect for that dress. I can't imagine anybody buying that clothing exactly the same as it was presented on the runway. And Helen Hunt has a very specific kind of figure.
But she looked beautiful. She really, in pure, here we go, and the camera was cool. As it is with me. As it is with anybody over 30. Which goes right back into the book. Because age sucks. Isn't that, I mean,
that's how you start off.
Yes.
You say aging sucks. Now, you must know there are an awful lot of people out there who disagree with you. They say in their golden years, they're smarter, wiser, and much more economically comfortable than they were before?
They are not smarter. They are not wiser. They, if anything, your brain cells are deteriorating. The only thing is you forget that you're stupider. I'm sick of hearing, oh, I'm having a senior moment. It's horrible. There's nothing nice to watch your body go down. Yes, you may have a little more money. Nobody cares. The shows aren't after you. The advertisers aren't after you. Good, so you can stock up on Depends. There is nothing... Nobody out there cares that we have more money.
But, Joe, do you think everybody's in showbiz?
It's true. Tell me what's wonderful about your golden years. Tell me right now. Tell me. I want to hear.
I'm finally becoming a success as I get older. Does that matter? I mean, all these years I've been schlepping along, unknown.
You're not. Tell me that makes.
You become more well-known, and the next thing you know, you're handsomer. Something happened.
This is very interesting.
Yeah.
And you think you're becoming more and more handsome. How old are you now?
Too old.
You're on your way down.
I'm in decline years.
You peaked.
I peaked and it looked interesting.
It gets worse. And the book is, how do we fight this? Because let's face it and let's move forward. It's not a depressing book. It's just face reality. Wouldn't you rather be? I'm not talking about what you're doing in your business.
Mm-hmm.
But most businesses now, early retirement, replaced by computers. You go out. Look who's taking me around from HarperCollins. She's 11 years old. I had to get her at recess. I mean, no, my agent is sitting there with a pacifier. It's no fun being the oldest in the room.
You say that there are certain basic things for staying young. You talk about what you call the importance of staying current.
Oh, yes. Don't you?
You're not talking AC/DC kind of
thing here. No, I'm very good. I'm talking about when you're a cupcake, whether you're a man or a woman, when you're good looking, you don't have to be anything. As you get older and you're at that table, you better bring something to the table. And part of that is you better be current. And I don't want to hear that wonderful, do you know 20 years ago we did, keep it to yourself. I want to know you read the latest book. I want to know you've seen the latest movie. I want to know you can work a computer. Stay current, because current is fun.
Don't you think when people get older, even if they stay current, they get more conservative?
That's okay, as long as you have an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to like Puff Daddy, but you should have heard a rap song so you can say, I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
If I have one more friend say, well, I stopped enjoying music with Alfred Lloyd Webber. if it's not Stephen Sondheim, I don't listen to it. Then you're an idiot. You're an ass.
You say a lot of it has to do with who you spend your time with. If you like to sit around with the girls or guys and reminisce about the good old days, this book is not for you.
Not for you. Because I just feel, first of all, again, and growing older is everybody. 35-year-olds tell me, I wish I were 29 again. My daughter Melissa's turning 30. She's so upset. Her friends are upset. So this is for anyone. Enjoy where you are at the moment, because you're going to look back 10 years from now and you're going to say, what was I upset about in 1999 when I did Leonard's show? I was very vital then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look back when I was, I turned 50. I got into bed for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think 50's one hot chickie. 50's just
ought to be 50 again.
Yeah, I'd like to be a real chicken and be 50 again. Hey, babes, check these out. You know,
you have a lot of diet advice.
Yeah.
You say eat all you want, just don't swallow it.
Yeah. You know who taught me that? I read a book, Archie Moore, the Price Fighter. Mm-hmm. When he had to lose weight, he chewed, swallowed the juices,
mm-hmm.
and then spit the food out. Now that's not attractive when you're with company.
No. But it's better than bulimia.
It's anything's better than bleeding, which I went through that too. Yeah, at least you're spitting out. You don't have to put your finger down.
You're right.
It saves your teeth.
You did fight bulimia?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and I still do.
Because that's a lifetime problem.
Yeah. And it's wonderful. Anyone, here we go again. To eat all you want and then throw it up, you're still full, and you've had an enjoyment of the food.
Mm.
So you really have to say to yourself, this is wrong. I am ruining my insides. I am ruining my teeth. I am not doing this anymore.
But if you just chew, take all the juices, you're getting all the vitamins, you're just not getting the bulk.
Right, and then bulk up on popcorn.
Now, there are some things that you, no matter what you do, it's not going to help. Pete Hamill tells a story. He was on the Dick Cavett Show with Mr. Rodale, the founder of that famous prevention magazine and all of that. I don't know if you know the story.
Go ahead.
So he's talking about living to be 100, and then suddenly he starts choking. They go to a commercial, and the man died right there. The show was never broadcast, in fact. But he was a person who knew everything about living forever. He lived the healthiest life. And he died while he was on the Dick Cavett Show, sitting on a couch.
Isn't he lucky? He was living in the now. He was not forgotten in a dusty old apartment. How wonderful. I hope to die. I always say to Melissa, I want to die on a stage in Vegas after 35 minutes because then they have to pay you for the hour.
So she'll get the money.
I said, I beg you, if you see me killing over 29, just stick them, tell them my mother's thinking.
I just want to get one more joke out here.
Got to be on stage at 35 to get paid for that performance. No, we're all going to die, and what's so terrible? And that's part. That's why I really talk about enjoy it. Don't whine. I have friends that I'm not happy. I don't feel good. I'm not going to go. Why do? Do it. You don't know if there's tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. What about all of the fads that we hear about, in fact, some of us indulge in? Shark cartilage, green algae,
yeah.
Vitamin mega dosing.
Yeah. It's all there in the book, and we talk about the pros and the cons.
What do you think?
I think it's all stupid.
So you don't do any of these things?
Oh, I do everything.
You take vitamin pills, don't you?
I take 27 a day. I can think it's
that's really multivitamin.
If you told me right now, Joan, are you taking vitamin J?
Yeah.
I'd say no, but I'll try it.
But with me, you know, I don't feel safe unless the thing says 6,000 times the minimum requirement for folic acid.
Yes. But you know, I'm very healthy. I don't have colds. So something in that pack of 162 vitamins that I'm taking every day is working.
Well, that's what Mr. Rodale said until he appeared on the Cavett Show. Now, you're here. I don't...
And
I'm,
I can
I'm
drop dead
I'm,
right now and,
yeah,
and
I'm not
air
Cavett,
the show.
You know?
I beg you, because it'll make a great rating. But all I guess the book is saying is it's lousy getting older. There is nothing wonderful about it. They have lied to us. But here's what we do about it, and enjoy it while you're here.
One of the things that you're critical of is when people try to remain young by dressing young. And we see these people who look like they're living a very strange schizophrenic life. Their face is saying one thing and their clothing is saying something totally different.
There's nothing worse, really, than a woman or a man. They reach a certain age and they're still in that micro mini and the legs and they're walking around and then they turn around and the hair going down the back, that blonde hair, and they turn around and it's Margot after Shangri-La. I mean, that's terrifying. Look in your mirror and say to yourself, if I saw that woman coming toward me on the street, would I say she looks like a fool or does she look great?
But don't you think people are blind to that?
Because you make yourself blind.
No,
I looked in the mirror today. I said, no more sleeveless dresses. Kills me to do that. But you've got, rather I say it to myself than someone sitting opposite me saying that poor old bitch, doesn't she know that her arms are crazy? It kills you. Life is very, aging is horrible. I mean, it's nothing nice what it does to your body physically or your mind.
You say street walking. Walking the streets is
walking,
good.
But street New York.
Street walking will keep you young.
Street walking, no, will depress
you. And you'll
make money, too. If I was street walking, I'd be rolling pennies at night. I'd be rolling sailors for pennies. Hey, sailor, how about it? 2 cents, huh? 5 cents.
2 cents plain.
5 cents. I beat you up a bit. I mean, walk. I do everything to keep healthy. I remember seeing Jackie Onassis going into Kenneth, that brilliant hairdresser salon, and he had a staircase at that point in that salon, and she was going to the third floor, she was walking upstairs, and I thought, good, walk, 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 carry your own bags, do your own everything, just try to keep yourself fit. That's all. Fit, fit, fit.
And when all else fails, we come to the P word. Plastic.
No, that's
surgery.
The first thing.
Oh, that's
plastic
the beginning.
Surgery immediately. Immediate. And I'm, and I, you know what upsets me? These women say, I can't afford it. Excuse me, you're in a new car. I would rather see a new face come out of an old car than an old face come out of a new car. I don't want to hear I can't afford it. Then get a second job and get it done.
Now, why is it important? Because it fights gravity?
It's important because of your own self-esteem. It's important because of the society we live in now is totally youth-oriented, and don't tell me no.
But how much is too much? I mean, people make fun of Mrs. Wildenstein, don't they?
And with good reason. I mean, she talks out of the top of her hair, you know. I cannot tell you. If she was going to breastfeed now, the kid would be sitting on her head. Too much is always too much, but almost better too much. I know. I was going to say she's got a goatee. I was going to say that. Should I not?
Shouldn't have. I know I'm going to get mail.
Oh, it's okay.
But you say you want to be buried with your plastic
absolutely.
Surgeon.
Absolutely. Who was it? The Indians that did that? They buried you with your servants, the Egyptians. I just want to be buried with my plastic surgeon and a really wonderful nurse. That's all. And a hairdresser maybe and a makeup woman.
But Joan, isn't this all a little superficial? In other cultures, the elders are revered as the wise ones, not like you say, the pruny ones.
Right, and I wish we were but we're not in another culture. We're in this culture. We're in this culture where Leonardo DiCaprio sold more covers off of more magazines than anyone else, than Arthur Miller. Let's go. What do you want? Albright's a different brand. Madeline Albright, nobody's got a poster up. Hey, hi. There's Madeline in that Rita Hayworth position on the desk, on the bed. Hello. Hi, Russians. I want to talk to all you guys at the UN now.
Maybe if she sent a poster to Milosevic,
we wouldn't be bombing. No, it's you know, you got to join him. You can't fight him. And again, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. This book is not for you. This book is for people that say, this is the reality of the situation. Now, what do I do to make the reality better?
My guest is Joan River, the author of a number of best-selling books, the host of cable TV's highly rated E! Pre-show commentary and fashion reviews for the Academy Awards, which we just saw, yeah. Also for the Golden Globe Award and the Emmy Award telecast. So you're covered at least during one season. Not the National Book Award yet. She can be heard nightly on her syndicated talk radio show and appears regularly with Regis and
Kathy Lee.
I can't say those names.
Yeah,
she's on
it,
Politically Incorrect. You've seen
all
her on QVC, and her latest book is Don't Count the Candles, Just Keep the Fire Lit. It's published by HarperCollins. This is Radio New York, AMA 20, WNYC. I'm Leonard Lopate. So is this book just for women? Because some people might say that you're reinforcing a very unfair double standard here by encouraging women to get facelifts and to try to look younger as they're getting older. But
men too.
But men often, I mean, Richard Chamberlain is an exception, isn't he? Men.
Chamberlain's scary. He's now the face on the iodine bottle. And I love Richard Chamberlain, but he should, whoever did him, he should get his check back.
But Clint Eastwood didn't do it.
Oh, grow up. When people in California say, I haven't had plastic surgery, they mean I haven't had plastic surgery today. Everybody has had something done, whether it's a little nip and a tuck, whether it's the neck. And you must to be viable. That's all about looks. Clint Eastwood, if he wants to continue to be a leading man, has to. Also, cleans your man
well,
out.
Sean Connery doesn't, but he does wear the toupee when he has to.
I have a feeling Sean Connery's done a bit. A man doesn't have to perhaps be as extreme as a woman, but take away a little bit. Vincent Price is my very dear friend. He would get what he used to call the rooster neck. He said, darling, I'm going in to get the rooster taken away. And never touched anything else but the rooster neck. And it makes me, you know something, if you look better, you feel better. And if it upsets you, men with eyelids that are coming down over the rest, do it. Do it.
But does it really matter? I get the feeling that a lot of what you're saying is that this is all about attitude. A 25-year-old who acts like an Alta Cocker is much less attractive than a 65-year-old who enjoys life.
Exactly right. And who people want to sit near. But the difference is to find out that you're enjoying life, you have to look good. Because we become invisible at a certain age. You go to a party, and how do you do? And the eyes jump right over you to somebody else. That's the reality of the situation. And if you're going to become one of the great people, let them know when they sit down, they get up from the table and say, I have just had the best time. Mary Lou Whitney, who is a friend of mine, 73, 74, whatever the hell she is. I remember the first time I had a party, I said to a friend of mine, very young man, 28-year-old man, straight guy. I said, I'm putting you next to me.
You have to point that out.
Yes, because it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. I said to him, I'm putting you next to Mary Lou. She's a little older, but you're going to enjoy it. He wasn't thrilled because I had three flowers also he wanted to sit next to at the table. He got up at dinner and said, I'm crazy about her. I'm crazy about her. She is funny. She is flirtatious. She's wonderful. But he didn't know. He had to be forced to know. Hmm. And that's what it's what I'm talking about in the book.
Make them happy
when they get next to you.
We also can say that a biannual facelift and a daily dose of Viagra doesn't hurt.
Does it hurt?
It doesn't
hurt. Does not hurt. Nothing hurts to make this terrible passage a little nicer.
To sum up the book, keep your chin up, not your chins up.
Yes. Yes.
A lot of this book comes out of the fact that you went through a pretty low time yourself, didn't you? As, you know, after Edgar, you had to regroup. Edgar.
But before, I'm in a business where it really is what you look like. It really is. TV now, someone was telling me, I won't mention a name. A friend of mine was a major star, but I mean major male star. Major! Who cannot get
guy's
a series.
Guy's name is Major.
I cannot get a series because they're now saying he's too old. Man is 62 years old.
Well, we saw that situation recently where that woman who was 30 lied and said she was, what, 16 or 17? She got the job,
her.
And then the minute they realized that she was older but looked young, they fired her.
What about the writers now? They're all 11 years. The only cast, the only writing group that still continues to be accepted are the NYPD. Mm-hmm. Not NY, is it? And Law and Order. Law and Order have the only mature writers. People that wrote MASH can't get jobs. Mm-hmm. And yet you watch a rerun of MASH and you say, this is brilliant. I have a friend that won 13 Emmys for the Mary Tyler Moore Show as a writer, and she was asked to take it off her resume. Her agent
made
said,
it too old.
Makes you too old.
Well, I sat across from Isabella Rossellini once and talked about how she'd been fired from a modeling gallery. I was looking into the face of one of the most beautiful women in the world.
And was fired because she was too old for Lancome. Too old. And they put in, what's her name? You know, the one that sleeps with Hugh Grant. whatever the hell her name is.
Elizabeth Hurley.
Elizabeth Hurley, who you know is also going to get kicked out when she hits 40.
I thought you were going to talk about that woman that he, or man, or whatever that he met in LA.
Yeah, well, we never saw her face, nor did he. But she's just doing top of the head commercials. The Monica Lewinsky School of Acting.
What did you think? Oh, should we get into Monica
of
just for a moment? Did you see her on Barbara Walters?
I did not watch it. I was appalled that she's become a celebrity. She is a girl, and I don't care if you know what I'm saying. She's a little, what we used to call my day, tramp. She was sleeping in high school with married teachers, sleeping around, said, I'm taking my presidential knee pads. It's a class act. And I'm going to Washington. Met the president same day. Gave him oral sex.
First gave him the thong.
Gave him the thong. And now suddenly it's this great love affair.
He sang to her, the thong is you.
We have to have another career for you, honey bunch. I just find it appalling.
I always wanted to be a poet.
And you are. And you are. But it upsets
me. So you see her as similar to a lot of people you've known over your life, except that she got a job as intern to the president and so has become famous.
She's become a celebrity. They were making a fuss over her at the Oscars. This is a girl who I said they should put her place card for dinner under the table. No one recognized. I put some ketchup on her dress. I gave her a stain.
She fell in love.
She fell in love. That's why she was sleeping with another man and had an abortion during the middle of it.
Well,
and no one wants to bring up these facts.
He was turning her down.
Oh, well, please. That's the word. No, she was. But the word down is a very prevalent thing in my recumbent.
Call her Moses.
You know, it's like all society today. It's Kato Kaelin, O.J. Simpson, Joey Buttafuoco. These are not celebrities. These are infamous. There's a difference between fame and infamy.
And you actually earned your celebrity. I mean, you are a truly funny person. There was a recent article in the New York Times about a symposium of the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival, and they had a whole bunch of funny people. Martin Short, James Brooks,
yes.
Penny Marshall, Neil Simon, you know, the usual suspects. And they all try to analyze what's funny, and they couldn't do it. Is it that hard to define?
It can't figure it out. It's looking at something cracked. You know that because you're funny. It's looking at something through a cracked mirror. It's finding a connection that everyone else goes, oh!
Mm-hmm. Your mind works that way. Sometimes I actually have to censor myself for obvious reasons. Well, because I'm not Joan Rivers and
wrong.
No?
God, that's also in my book.
You don't
book.
Know how much mail I get.
Well, and they're wrong. They don't listen to you. You know, if they don't get it, let me tell you, God gave us the ability to laugh. We're the only animal, and I talk about this in the book, which keeps you young, only animal. You never saw two cows going, do the farmer impression. When you laugh, everything works in your body. Your blood pressure goes down. Your heart rate goes back to normal. It's fabulous. And people say, you shouldn't laugh at that. You should laugh at everything.
But you know that some people feel that you sometimes go over the edge.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm too old now to give a damn. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I guess I should be wearing no excuses jeans. I don't care anymore. What are you going to do to me? It's been done to me. Mm-hmm. That's the only good thing about age.
Well, part of what's what makes you so surprising is that you do seem to be able to say the thing that others would be
thinking
or be afraid to say. You know, and if it's some might judge it distasteful. They're still laughing at the same time they're saying, oh, that's terrible. How
but
could
they
you do
also
that?
Say it in private life to mm-hmm. each other. My daughter and I just did a mother-daughter luncheon for a very fanfan group out in L.A. And not one show business person in the crowd. You know, it was all that rich, mm-hmm. old L.A. money.
They don't open their mouths when they talk. They talk like the teeth class.
You got it. I call them WAPs. WASP American Princesses. Uh-huh. And well, he said, we have questions and answers. Everything was about sex. They still want to know.
And they asked your daughter about sex?
Oh, well, do you think that so-and-so was sleeping with so-and-so? I mean, it was all about the Oscars and the sex going on. And then you would tell them the truth. They go, oh! Then they laugh. Mm-hmm. It's what everybody knows and wants to know about.
She's in the business now.
Yes, she is.
Is there a funny gene, do you think?
Totally different, mm-hmm. but it's genetic. People come up to me and say, Melissa's so funny. And but very different kind of funny. Oh, I think it's all inherited. I think there's nothing, you can't learn to be funny.
In that symposium, they said there are certain topics that are obviously off limits. The Holocaust, I guess, Amadou Diallo, things like that. But the line has moved, hasn't it? I remember when Lenny Bruce was shocking. You hear those things today.
Sweet.
Yeah, it seems almost innocent. How could this man have been arrested for telling those stories?
It's moved so far now. But I think that's good. I think if you can laugh at everything. So you think maybe we should... the Holocaust, I know, was tough. I was very angry that people were calling Life is Beautiful a funny movie. Mm-hmm. Then you missed the whole point of what Life is Beautiful is about.
I didn't like it.
I loved it.
So
yeah, see, that's... But did you not like it because it was making the Holocaust funny?
It trivialized the Holocaust as far as
concerned. I thought it was...
And Benigni just drives me crazy.
Well, he's too happy. Yeah, I love you. Bill. Oh, yeah. Shut up.
I wonder if he ever relaxes.
I bet you he goes home and hates everybody. It's like Charlie Chaplin.
Take 7 Prozacs and call me in the morning.
But wasn't it also nice, though, to see somebody so happy instead of being gracious?
Well, that's true.
Yeah, I said, when he walked on the stairs, on the backs of the seats, I said, oh, good for him. Mm. It's like when Jack Nicholson comes up stoned out of his mind and gets funny. Love moments like that. If indeed he is stoned, allegedly.
You think that that's part of the act, the image that Jack is promoting?
I just think he is so great. I just love him. I just think he is so funny. He's one that you think it is totally extemporaneous.
Robin Williams, I still thought, had the best line there when he said, the whole Kazan thing. He said, let Lainey sing.
Yeah, is that hilarious? Yeah I love that.
Because, that's what humor is all about. It's the surprise. I mean, we're so focused on Ilya Kazan, and then he says Lainey.
And it breaks it up.
Yeah.
I thought it was wonderful. But I love all that. I love controversy. I thought that gave the only edge to the Oscars.
Mm, they were kind of predictable, weren't they?
Very.
The only surprise, I think, was Benigni winning Best Actor.
Yeah.
Everybody thought it was going to be Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
I did because I thought he was great.
He's so good. He's so underrated. He's always like the poor man's Harrison Ford, and he shouldn't be. He's so terrific.
You saw Affliction.
Loved it. I didn't love it. I mean, you talk about a tough movie to watch.
Didn't love it, but I thought it was brilliant.
Well, you know, I'm a girl from Larchmont. I'm not identifying here. But I'm enjoying it.
Are you bicoastal these days?
I'm very bicoastal. Mm. Yeah. My daughter,
6 months here, 6 months
no,
there, but not...
back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I have 3 dogs there, 3 dogs here. So I have 6 dogs that say, where the hell are you going?
Well, who takes care of them when you're in the
My
other place?
My daughter takes care of the other three, and they moved to her house now.
Really?
It's very sad. That's the only thing with pets. It breaks your heart, you know. You're going? They're the only ones that care.
So, let's spill. What dress did you think was the best? Was it Helen Hunt?
I thought Helen Hunt in real life looked fabulous. I thought, of course, Gwyneth Paltrow, and people saying that the top didn't fit. She walked in with such elegance, such grace, such charm under pressure. Her parents, here we go, an older person, don't count the candles. Her parents did some good job. Mm-hmm. Whatever went on in that household, something was done absolutely correctly.
Well, there is a complaint that many of the younger actresses just don't know how to walk.
Yeah, or talk, or be gracious, or understand
and that she has
have
that
a little
grace.
Style. Yeah.
Proving your point, Sophia Loren.
You talk about holding back the dam. She must have 75 ladies with fingers all over the place in that dam. She looked... And you can't, and
she's
the book
gorgeous,
is about,
right?
But for her age, now let's discuss Sophia Loren. The hair was a little fuller for her age, perfect. The breasts were really covered. There was a little piece of black net, which you probably didn't notice. You still saw cleavage, but you saw cleavage under gauze. Mm-hmm. I thought she looked so fabulous and looked like a fabulous looking sexual woman, but a sexual mother, not a teeny bopper, and you knew she was wearing underwear, and probably a corset.
And most of them are not wearing underwear.
You can't with those two headdresses.
Some of those dresses, a panty line would be disgusting.
Yes, would be disgusting, and I would mention on the fashion review, which will be on, I think, Saturday and Sunday. By the way,
a caller wanted to point out that there's another side to Joan Rivers, that you've helped Literacy Partners tremendously, and many other charities. You see that as your responsibility?
I see that absolutely as my responsibility. I think if you don't give... I think everything comes around at you. Absolutely. I think so much has been given to me. I think, first of all, my money's a conduit. Every antique dealer knows that.
I used
that.
To live in a conduit. Sorry. So you might... But yeah,
I give back. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I pick my charities. I think adult literacy... You open the world for some... You are never alone with a book. We all know that. That's your friend.
Would you mind talking to some of the members of the audience?
Only if they're single and terribly wealthy, of course.
Okay. Of course. The number here is 212-267-WNYC. That's 212-267-9692. Only if you're young and what? Wealthy?
Not young. Only if you're... I don't know what I even
you're
said.
Looking
wealthy.
For a rich husband?
Aren't we all? Aren't we all
I'm
still?
I'm not.
Oh, you should. I wouldn't mind getting a rich wife at this point. Who cares?
So I have to dump the one I got?
Oh, keep her on the side.
So I should get a rich mistress, you're saying?
Your wife will move over, too, at this point. It's okay, as long as she knows she's getting the fur coat.
When are you going to come back to the theater? You said that your Tony nomination was
the most
your
important
pride
nomination.
And joy.
Yeah. Isn't that funny?
And Jackie Mason keeps on recycling the same material. You always have new material.
No. I would never come back with my act. You want to see my act? Go to Vegas. I won my Tony nomination for Sally Marr and her escorts, which was a thing I wrote on Lenny Bruce. Thing. And now we're working on, again, Older Love. And
you are doing another play.
Oh, yeah. I have another play. We did the first
one. But you wouldn't do your act. Why?
My act is not Broadway. Broadway, I am a
you
New York
it,
girl.
Didn't you?
Never on Broadway. I've done Carnegie Hall. I've done, no, Broadway is Broadway.
I remember the last time we were here, we talked about how you broke into the theater with Barbara Streisand.
Yes, Driftwood.
Yes, she was a teenager.
Yes, and I was her lesbian lover. We were two, really. And she had the best makeup case I've ever seen for an 18-year-old. But no.
She never had the plastic surgery.
Oh, yes. Leonard, I mean, I can't get your wife to interview me next time. Everybody has little things done. She's never done major things, but there have been things. Come on. And the chin line. That's what I hate about actresses. When an average woman is sitting out there and you're 52 years old and your face is sagging and you look at someone, I don't mean Streisand, but you look at Streisand and this chin is fine. She says, I've done nothing. I can't stand this.
But she just didn't do the nose.
No, she thinned the nose, I've been told. And why not?
And your new play is going to be?
We don't know. It'll be a year from February.
February. Back
for that. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, let's take some calls. Michael from Long Island, you're on the air.
Hello, Joan.
Hi, Michael.
How are you, dear?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm 27, and I'm a stockbroker, and I'm looking to get married. Can you help me?
Yes, get a girl. Can I help you? You're making a joke. I'm telling you, get a girl that's also about 27. Okay. Don't look for a chickie.
I wanted just to say that I did agree with you when you talked about life is beautiful. I think that the comedy doesn't necessarily make fun of things or trivialize things, but I think it can show a darker side of things, which I think they did really well in that movie. And I just want to say I love you.
Thank you, Michael. And any way to get the Holocaust story out, get it out there.
Well, you remember that Jerry Lewis did a movie about a clown in the Holocaust.
Right. Right.
And they've never shown it.
And they're, well, because we beg them not to. Because of
the Did you see it?
No. I avoid seeing Jerry Lewis movies. I don't
find it. It comes out. He made some good. You never saw The Nutty Professor?
Are you out of your mind?
What? That's a great film.
I don't want to see The Nutty Professor with Jerry Lewis, okay?
I just don't want to see the ones where he says,
and he walks on his ankles. But I that's not my kind of comedy. And again, the French love them, but what do they know? They piss in the streets. They carry bread under their sweaty arms, and then they eat it.
The French Jerry Lewis and pissoirs. Well, we have a call from a different Joan. You're on the air.
Hi. How do you find a good plastic surgeon for your chin or a special part of your face?
Right, because you know there are a lot of people have problems,
yes.
And even rich people have sued their plastic surgeons for moving their navels
but
and stuff.
But nothing is 100%. This is what you do. You go to a beauty shop. Ask your beauticians, because they see the ladies and they see the scars and the heads. They'll know who's done a good job. That's one. Always ask in a beauty shop. Ask your and make sure you're asking your gay hairdresser. Mm-hmm. Number one, ask your GP. Mm-hmm. Then go and interview them and talk to them. So much of it's rapport. So much of it's about I like him, he likes me, that you can talk to him and tell him what you want.
And then it's also important to find somebody who isn't ready to do everything to you. You don't want, you know, there are these people who wind up with their lips puffed up. Unless you want it.
But also ask your dermatologist. Dermatologists are just a step away from plastic surgeons. Mm-hmm. And meet them and talk to them. And again, don't expect major. You know what the great plastic surgery job is? That you look cleaned up, fresh, and nothing's drooping.
Mm-hmm. And not tired.
Exactly. You look fresh.
But I still don't know how to find one.
Where do you live?
Manhattan.
Excuse me?
Just walk down the street. You'll bump into one.
Literally, truly, go into whoever your doctor is, your GP, and let him start giving you names.
Thank you for calling us.
Foster's a good name. I know that. Dr. Foster. I know two friends of mine that went to him. Dr. Foster. I think he's on Park Avenue.
Foster. Look it up in the book. Dorothy from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hello, Joan.
Hi, Dorothy.
My mother is 65, and she's said to me that she's willing to have face surgery, but she won't do anything about her graying hair. Do you have any suggestions?
She's wrong.
I think she would look 10 times better.
Then you know what you do? You give her...
And she won't pierce her ears ever.
Well, pierce her ears, okay.
What about a nose ring?
Wait a second. How about giving a diamond earring she'll pierce? But don't worry about the piercing.
Wait, what about nose rings? They keep you young, don't they?
Yeah, but
what about those things in your lips?
But you got to look. Read in my book. You have to know when you say, I can't wear a nose ring anymore. That's what part of don't count the...
Do her hair, dye her hair. It's gray.
I think she'll look 10 years younger.
Thank you.
10
I
years
know
younger.
I she respects your opinion.
Tell her to try it. You don't like it and come out the next week.
Okay.
Try it while you can walk to the beauty shop, while you can see it.
Okay.
That's my motto.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
JC from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yes, I want to tell Joan that I really like her.
Thank you.
She's a very, very alive person, if you will. I wanted to ask you about one thing. I don't know if you remember. In the very, very early days of rap music, hip-hop, I remember even myself being a black person. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. It was, you know, something that, you know, homeboys, teenagers did. I remember... maybe I'm mistaken. You are one of the first people who interviewed Run DMC.
That's right. Right on my show.
It was amazing to me how you borrowed one of their hats, or you probably brought your own, and you started rapping with them.
Sure. I had the best time. And you know what you find? Underneath two-thirds of these guys that look so tough, they're adorable, and they all say, do you think my mother can get a tape?
I don't know.
Thank you, LL Cool J.
He's one of those as well. A guy who gives a lot of money to literacy programs as well.
Puff Daddy is so adorable. Puff Daddy, who came to the Oscars and said, "Where's Joan? I want to talk to Joan."
Well, he hasn't invited me to any of his famous parties, so
me?
I'm not
ready.
I'm
invited nothing.
Myra calling on a cell phone. Hi, Myra.
Hi, how are you? I'm so excited to call.
You're on a cell phone, Myra. You shouldn't do this. Go ahead.
Yeah.
This is true. I pulled to the side, actually.
Okay, talk.
Everyone was talking about how great Helen Hunt looked at the Oscars. I thought her eye makeup was so dark and black. Her eyes looked like they were little slits.
Myra,
no
again.
One can imagine that.
She took it from the runway. That's how Gucci showed it, with the long hair and the dark eyes. Now, Gucci got raves. That's what I yell about. Don't have the New York Times say, "Gucci, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant." Then poor Helen Hunt goes and copies it, and they go, "You look stupid." They better make up their minds. Is this good or bad?
Well, I just think that, you know, you couldn't. She went on that little pre-show with, what's her name? Gina Davis.
We never discussed that. Continue.
Gina Davis, the competition.
I know what you're saying. Yeah. Not anymore. One shot, Gina. No, but truly, in real life,
that was a deadly show. I think Gina Davis is one of the most beautiful actresses in the world. But
she's one of the most beautiful women. Hardly an actress. You see, but Pirate Island.
That was her husband directed that.
Put her on that pre-show for it.
They tried to get cut into us, and it was very ugly. It was an ugly, ugly thing that ABC did, and they really did a disservice to themselves and to the Academy.
I want to talk about this for a moment, Joan.
Myra, anyhow, truly in real life, she looked beautiful. I'm so sorry for poor Helen.
I want to talk about this other thing. I think this is a serious moment. Everybody is a potential talk show host. Have you noticed?
I mean, they don't know. The
Donnie and Marie Osmond are talk show hosts. Anybody who wants to be a talk show host can be a talk show host. If you're a failed fascist dictator, if you're a former basketball player.
Cato Kaelin had it for a while. They all.
What do they think this is easy?
They think it's easy. What ABC did, which was so stupid, they took away the half hour because we were like the little major. We're like the little event before, and they were going to steal that hour away and give it to ABC. It's all dollars and cents, and they made us stop. They wouldn't let us continue to stand on the red carpet. They made us shut down. They should have said, "We're doing it. You guys can continue." Mm-hmm. They made us.
You're
stop.
No competition. ABC
well,
is
ABC
in every
is a
home.
Big,
and, yeah,
ABC's E. Goliath.
You got nice ratings.
E is a little tiny cable station that happens to do great on the award shows. Then they got Gina Davis, and she was very badly advised that all she did was give out statements for 3 months before saying, "Unlike Joan and Melissa, I'm not going to be screaming, 'What are you wearing?'" And finally, Melissa, and I wouldn't answer. Finally, Melissa said, "Why doesn't she wait and see what's going to happen when she's out there?" And her first question to Helen Hunt was, "Let me see your dress, turn around." So she was not good, and she was very imperious and very arrogant about the whole thing. And she didn't, and I hate to say I'm glad she failed, because you don't like to see anybody fail. But sometimes maybe it's good to learn a lesson at her not so young age. Read Don't Count the Candles, Gina. You'll see how to take it with grace now that you're getting older.
Rebecca, you have to make it quick.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Joan. I wondered if your fear of aging had to do with getting a man or fear of death.
Not fear of death, because I've been, I think death is very comforting. I don't like the process getting there. But, you know, it's not fear of aging. I don't like to see thighs that are wrinkled. I don't like to lift an arm and see an arm that is wrinkled. I don't like to see
this
a chest.
This is aesthetic?
It's an aesthetic thing. It upsets me that I cannot run those six flights of stairs anymore. I can't tell you, if you're enjoying this process, then you're a very lucky woman. I think you're in the minority. I don't like walking past the construction site and not having someone say, "Isn't she cute? Isn't she good looking?" I don't like it.
I'm going to sneak Janet in here, but it has to be very fast, Janet.
Yes, it'll be very fast. I wanted to say to Joan, when you speak of your dogs, sometimes I can almost see a tear in your eye. And when you speak of Melissa, but I've wondered how you feel after you've pulled a person down, and I'm wondering why you do so much of that when you don't have to do that.
Tell me who I've pulled down.
Who have I
pulled down?
I have to end it there. It's
not
true.
Who have I pulled down? Elizabeth Taylor? Everybody did Elizabeth Taylor jokes. You know why you remember mine? They were the best. Who have I pulled down?
We thank you very much for your call.
You know, they all think, they all think that. Keep talking.
You're a pin cushion. Okay. Yeah. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Joan Rivers' latest book is called Don't Count the Candles, Just Keep the Fire Lit. It's published by HarperCollins. It's always
a lot of fun. I
truth
never laugh as hard with other
guests.
It's not
pulling down.
1, 2, 3, 4. When you put that weight on my shoulder, when you put that hook in my mouth, it pulls me down like a concrete kite. Oh, what do you like? Then you kick that chair from below me, leave me swinging in the drowning seat. We used to be friends, now we just fight. Oh, what do you like?
Graham Parker from the soundtrack of a new film called This Is 40. Judd Apatow is our guest. He wrote, directed, and produced it. It opens in theaters around town. And how did Graham Parker get involved in all of this? Is someone that Paul Rudd's label is trying to make a go with?
I thought it would be fun to show the struggles that Paul Rudd's character is having as a owner of a small record label. So he puts out all the people that he loves, like Paul Westerberg and Frank Black and all the kind of the great indie rock gods. And you know, there are so many of these people, they continue to put out amazing records, but they're not selling as many records as Rihanna. And I wish they should. They deserve to. But,
there's a joke in there. I think he sold 700 CDs.
Well, Graham Parker's not selling a lot of CDs. And I think the music business is a little bit in disarray as a result of digital downloading and that transition not working very well. So I needed a band that would agree to be in the movie as representing an artist who's not selling a lot of records. Graham Parker is one of the great rock legends who, you know, he came up before Elvis Costello and The Clash at about 1974. And he broke up his band, Graham Parker and the Rumor, in 1980, and has put out a lot of records since then that are excellent. So I heard that Graham was interested in working with me through his website. So I took him out to lunch and I told him a little bit about the movie.
But he's a butt of a joke here.
Yeah, I told
him. Was he at all concerned that the plot involves the fact that no one buys his records anymore?
Well, I told him that, and he said to me, yeah, I'm not selling a lot of records. And he laughed about it. And in fact, there was a documentary I watched about him, and in it he said, you know, a lot of people pay their dues in the beginning of their career. I'm paying mine now. So he's really funny and self-effacing, but also very confident as an artist because his albums are great. And there's so many people who continue to put out great records that don't sell. So he was game to do a Larry Sanders Show type treatment on his career and the music industry. And so he's really funny and goofs on himself hard in the movie because there's a lot of jokes about older rock stars and older rock stars not looking good and not selling a lot of records. But what's happened is since the movie started, he went on tour with Graham Parker and The Rumor.
The Rumor got together. This was an opportunity for them to reunite.
They got together. They made a record. The record's selling really well, and they did a sold-out tour across America, and they're going to do more dates next year. So he made fun of himself as if his career is not going well, and that got him so much publicity that his career is going well. So it worked perfectly.
You also had a bunch of other artists do the soundtrack. Did you start approaching them before you began shooting? Because you can't always just get Fiona Apple, Nora Jones, Lindsay Buckingham, and Ryan Adams to contribute to a soundtrack.
I did. I'm usually afraid to ask people to write original songs for a movie because I think, what if they give me a terrible song and I have to, you know, tell someone I worship that I hate their song? But I said, I'm just going to go for it this time. And so Lindsay Buckingham came over to my house one day with a guitar, and we talked about the types of songs we would need and kicked around some titles. And then he went off and he wrote 5 songs. We recorded 3 of them that are on the soundtrack. And the same with Nora Jones. She wrote a beautiful song that we use as score in a lot of the movie. And Wilco recorded a remake of an old song of theirs, but a kind of a bluegrass treatment of an old song called I Got You. And we had this guy who is a genius named John Bryan, who did the score to Magnolia, and he produced one of Kanye West's albums and a lot of Fiona's albums. And what he did is he recorded with all of these artists, but he had them all play on each other's songs. And he also had the Punch Brothers, play on all of the songs. So even though there's a, you know, there's a Lindsey Buckingham song, Norah Jones sings backup on it, and Lindsey Buckingham plays guitar on her song. So he did this really fascinating tapestry with all these people in a way no one ever does it.
And that makes for a good soundtrack album as well.
It's a, yeah, the record is great, available on iTunes.
I'm assuming that you also see making a film as an opportunity to work with some people you want to work with, like Albert Brooks, who is one of the funniest people in the world.
That's true.
And here he plays the very annoying father of Paul Rudd in a, as you mentioned earlier, kind of parent-child role reversal relationship. He keeps on hitting up his son for money. He's like the child of his son. Is that based on somebody you knew?
You know, it's based on an enormous amount of relationships that we've seen over the years. I think that, you know, people are living for a really long time. There's a lot of people who didn't assume they had to save that much for their retirement. And I think that a lot of people are having economic problems, and suddenly they have to turn to their children for help. And it creates a new, very sensitive dynamic where you can become the parent to one of your parents. And it's also very funny because it's Albert Brooks. Mm. And what complicates it is his wife really wanted a child. So at 60, they did in vitro, and he didn't think it would work. But his wife wound up having triplets. So he's having financial problems, and he has many children. And he's so funny in this very, very difficult situation.
And the other father-in-law, John Lithgow, playing Leslie's emotionally remote father.
Yes, John Lithgow is one of my favorite actors of all time. He's in my favorite movie, Terms of Endearment. I only realized after we shot the movie that I had stolen the Oscar-nominated Best Supporting Actor from two James Brooks movies, Albert Brooks for Broadcast News and John Lithgow for Terms of Endearment. You know, I've been reticent to work with a lot of my heroes because I would never want to put them in a bad movie because I respect them so much. But I did it this time, and they were so helpful. I mean, they have just so much experience to bring to the table. And in rehearsals, when you talk through the character and the story, people like John Lithgow help you find new depths that you didn't even know were there.
Do you encourage them to improvise?
What we do is we go into rehearsal and we read all the scenes, and then we have long conversations about what it means and what the tone should be. And then I'll rewrite and we'll improvise. And then I go off and I do a major revision based on these work sessions. So by the time we get to the set, the script is pretty locked. But what I tend to do is remember all these funny things they said in rehearsals, and I make them record all of those when we shoot.
I assume that's what happened with Melissa McCarthy, who's outrageous as the parent of one of Maude's classmates, you know, the daughter's classmates. Although the outtake of the scene where she explodes in the principal's office is something that people who leave while the credits are rolling will regret having missed.
She's so funny. Melissa McCarthy I met when we did Bridesmaids, and she's on that show Mike and Molly. She's in, you know, just a few scenes in the movie, and they're the funniest scenes in the movie because she is truly, you know, as funny as anyone I've ever met, and she plays a disgruntled parent who gets into a really big argument with Leslie and Paul about how their kids are communicating on the internet.
You couldn't use that scene because Leslie and Paul are cracking up during the scene?
Well, if what you notice is that I shot that scene with three cameras, so when Melissa's doing her lines, you see her on a single. But then when you show the wide shot, you see that the whole time Melissa's doing her lines, Leslie and Paul are trying not to laugh, and their faces are there's snot coming out, there's tears. And so it's actually not ruining her single. They're just ruining the wide shot.
Now, you also have Megan Fox playing Desi, a hyper-productive salesperson who works in Debbie's store. This is a far cry from the Transformers.
It's very different. I mean, I always feel bad for people who have so much more to offer. I mean, she's a beautiful, beautiful woman, and she's great in the Transformers movies and these action movies, but she's also hilarious and a very sympathetic actress. She's really, really wickedly funny and was as funny as anyone else when we got into our rehearsals and tried to conceive of these characters. So I'm excited that people have responded to her in such a big way.
You also use some other things you knew, obviously. Leslie dancing. She's
yes.
bad and funny about it at the same time.
And she's trying to be a good dancer. It's just not working out.
You use her in the 40-year virgin as well.
Yes, that's right. Anytime Leslie tries to dance, she really thinks she's good in life. And then she's like, why is this funny? And I'm like, don't worry about it.
Now, can you tell me about the selection of books you chose for the Wall Street Journal that would represent you? My ideal bookshelf. Some of those books, I'm not surprised by. Albert Brooks's novel 2030 is on the list. Steve Martin's Born Standing Up. I'm assuming that they had an influence. But we also have Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life. Saul Bellow Sees the Day.
That's right.
Not surprised to see Lenny Bruce there.
Yes, this was a project that it's a book called My Ideal Bookshelf. And what they did is they asked all sorts of people what their ideal bookshelf would look like. So, you know, they said, you know, give us a dozen books. And they do a beautiful painting of what that bookshelf would look like. And so I just listed some of my favorite books. You know, Saul Bellow is obviously one of the great novelists of all time, and it's very dark and also darkly funny. Tobias Wolff is someone whose short stories and memoirs I've enjoyed for a very long time. I tend to like people who have humor. You know, Tobias Wolff is also very funny in addition to being very dramatic.
Well, hadn't you originally wanted to be a stand-up?
I did. I wanted to be a stand-up. I only wanted to be Jerry Seinfeld or Jay Leno when I was a kid. And I did stand-up for 7 years and slowly realized that my ideas worked better when written into dramatic situations. You know, my comedic thoughts were best played out as theater.
Or television, because you worked a lot on television, including the Ben Stiller show, Larry Sanders show we mentioned. So how did you, or when did you, what led to the jump into directing your first feature film, The 40-Year-Old Virgin?
You know, I never pursued directing. When I went to college, I studied screenwriting, and we did some directing classes, and I always felt like I wasn't very good. I went to school with a lot of very talented people who were so much better than me. It scared me off of directing in a lot of ways. And then I...
In what way? Directing as directing actors or moving the camera so that you tell the story in the best way possible?
Yeah, I think like the physical part of it and the visual part of it. One of the people I went to school with, his name was Matt Reeves, who created Felicity. And he just did that movie, the American version of Let the Right One In. He's just... really, really was brilliant during college. Like when he would show the film he made, it was so remarkable that it made me embarrassed to show mine. And then I was just always afraid the eye lines wouldn't match. I just thought like literally it wouldn't make sense. Not that it would be bad, that it like fit, like it wouldn't even, it would look like some insane Ed Wood movie. and I never pursued it. And then when I was producing at the Larry Sanders Show, Shanling said to me, oh, you have to direct an episode before we stop doing this. And he made me do it. And it wasn't something I asked to do. I was very scared. And he helped me. And then I said, okay, I should learn how to do this. So when we did Freaks and Geeks, I directed 4 episodes. And that's when I really learned how to do it.
And then you had to convince people to give you money to make The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
That's right. I think after Anchorman was a success, the studio realized that making movies at a reasonable budget with really funny people who were not super expensive because they weren't stars yet was a good business model. And Steve Carell had this idea for The 40-Year-Old Virgin, so we wrote it together and did it, you know, inexpensively. And we still make our movies pretty inexpensively. And because that did well, they were like, well, what other ideas do you have? Well, we got Superbad, we got Pineapple Express, and then suddenly the train was moving.
Because when you make a film that's not all that expensive and it makes millions and millions of dollars, it makes a lot of people happy.
You know, they are very happy and they trust you more when something succeeds. You know, they think, well, maybe they know what they're doing. And then they let you be more creative because you can't predict what will make people laugh or what movie people will like. It's just it's all a guessing game, and so they really bet on talent once you've proven yourself.
Are you already working on your next project?
Well, I'm a producer on the sequel to Anchorman, so that's going to shoot in March, and then I'm producing the we're about to shoot the third season of Girls. Mm-hmm. The second season of
what
Girls.
What does producing mean in those circumstances?
Well, with Girls, what it means is I'm the guy who's looking for trouble. I'll write a little bit with Lena. I'll write an episode or two. I'm working with her and Jenny Connor, the other showrunner, to arc out the season and to be part of the writing process. And I'm also involved in just the basic mechanics of, getting all the, making sure we have enough money to make the show and the marketing and, all the other details that most people don't realize that we have to spend 8 hours debating what should be on the poster.
You have included your kids in a couple of your movies. Are you worried that they'll become show business kids? Do you want them to go in show business?
You know, what's funny is I didn't put my kids in the movie because I want them to be actresses. I put them in the movie because I thought it would make the movie better. I never thought they would be really great, and now I would have to field offers for them. I wasn't trying to launch anything. So now, if Peter Jackson calls, I will hang up on him.
Well, they could be in the third Hobbit film.
They could be little troll creatures.
You're from Syosset. Welcome home.
That's right. I am. I'm from Long Island. Syosset and Woodbury. I lived in the Gates at Woodbury, and I was there till I went to college. I had an amazing childhood. As I look back, it really was an idyllic place to grow up.
Judd Apatow's latest film is This Is 40. It opens this Friday at theaters all around town. You can also see the third season of the popular HBO series Girls, which he produces. And I'm assuming there's another film this time, probably starring Megan Fox, because
That's
you
right.
like to take the minor characters and give them their own films.
I would go to that movie.
Thanks so much for being with us.
It was great to be here.
I don't remember where we were and young. Oh, that's faded in my memory. I feel like somebody I don't know. Are we really who we used to be? Am I really who I was? All the lights draw you in, and the dark will take you down, and the night will break your heart.